The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Last show of the week. Lots to get into on this Friday. Hopefully, in the second segment, we'll have enough time to go through some of our listener feedback. If you'd like to contact the program, you can do so by sending an email to td@kpcg.fm. Well, the French Prime Minister now says the ringleader behind last week's attacks in Paris used the refugee crisis to slip into France. And this has to make, among others, it has to make Chancellor Merkel just a little bit uncomfortable in Germany, as there was a report just earlier this week about the AFD, the far-right wing party, the anti-immigration party, that now has an approval rating of 10%, way up, rather, from 3%. This is a party, according to one article I saw, that's only been around for a couple of years, but now it's drawing quite a lot of support within Germany, polling above 10%, as I say. More details have come in, by the way, of this near miss, this attack that was in the works on Tuesday night, I believe it was, with this football match in Hanover, Germany, between Germany and the Netherlands. Evidently, there was a five-member terrorist cell that was planning to bomb five different locations. Three of them were to be detonated at the stadium itself, and two others were to be detonated at a bus stop in a train station. And so, as you might have heard, Tuesday night, this was just a couple of hours before the match was set to begin, German authorities called the match off after receiving tips from French intelligence that these bombs were going to go off. Now, since that time, no arrests have been made with anyone directly connected to this plot. But evidently, the sources are credible that this was in the works. You can certainly see why there's so many people in Europe. And of course, if you're in the United States, you see a lot of discontent there as well, particularly with respect to the Syrian refugee crisis and the question of all these refugees streaming into the countries of Europe, the United States, and others. This piece from the Telegraph here regarding the concerns that many have in Germany. It says that Germany could send troops into the streets for the first time since the war, since World War II. And that's a phrase, by the way, that we're going to be reading and hearing a lot in the months and years ahead. For the first time since the war. For the first time since the war. How many times are we going to be reading that in the months ahead? History's repeating itself. Only this time it's going to be on a much worse scale than it was even in World War II, as hard as that is to believe for so many. The Telegraph says Wolfgang Schauble, the finance minister, has publicly called for the military to be used in the event of coordinated terror attacks on a German city. He says if we had a situation like Paris, perhaps with attacks in three or four places, we'd have to think about whether our police capabilities are enough. This is what he told a German newspaper. What can we do to support security forces that are already overwhelmed on some normal weekends in the face of great challenges? The Telegraph says the minister's comments have reopened the debate over the military's role in modern Germany, where much of the public remains deeply sensitive to the idea of soldiers on the streets. Here again, not since the Second World War, or the first time since the war. The Telegraph says, under the Constitution, the armed forces can be deployed in a crisis, but until now, they have only been used to help with relief after natural disasters. Well, now there's discussion of bringing them on the streets to fight against terrorism. Is the world at war, like so many commentators are now saying? Well, we're certainly at the early stages of this period that many Bible prophecies speak of. We know it's triggered by the clash, the Daniel 11:40 clash. And that after that, every nation in the world is drawn into this conflict. And Jesus Christ has to intervene. God has to intervene on the affairs of this earth. As Matthew 24, verses 21 through 22 say, to put a stop to it, to end it before man ends human civilization. That's what Christ said. That's the message that Jesus Christ proclaimed about the end of this age. So many prophecies are being fulfilled. You know it. If you're familiar with Herbert Armstrong, if you're familiar with any of his writings, you know that we're living in the very last days. Yesterday I talked about these groups in Europe, the European Union, these smaller groups of five states here or five states there, talking about pulling together, talking about however you want to describe it, a smaller version of Schengen, a smaller version of the Union, a two-tiered Europe, as many have said, or two phases, two speeds. We're seeing it whittled down to the core. The 10 kings, the 10 nations. I quoted from that report, Stratfor, yesterday. I think it was from yesterday morning or Wednesday night, perhaps. In any event, it's now, at the time, some of these same details about officials in the Netherlands opening up these negotiations with neighboring countries, neighboring governments, seeking to break up the Schengen zone, that passport-free Schengen zone, which is what's made it so easy for migrants, refugees, and even terrorists to move in and around Europe, just like the mastermind to the attacks last week. And, of course, the French PM, he made it seem like there was more than one, more than the mastermind, as there were many involved in this attack. How many of them slipped into Europe? How many of them slipped into France because of the refugee crisis? This Stratfor piece, and now the same information in the Times of London. The title at the Times is Mini Schengen Zone to Secure Borders. The Netherlands has opened negotiations with neighboring countries to seek to break up the passport-free zone in order to control the influx of migrants. It says, if agreed, the new zone, which has been discussed at the highest levels of the Dutch government and with interior ministers from the other countries, would herald the end of the EU's 26-country Schengen area. A deep rift, notice this, a deep rift would also be driven between the new bloc and other countries by reintroducing passport controls on sensitive borders, such as the Franco-German frontier. Well, this would cause some friction in this union of nations, this mixture of iron and miry clay. Is it important to keep an eye on what's happening with respect to this potential breakup of the Schengen zone? Think again about what it says in Daniel 2. We went through this yesterday. The two legs and the 10 toes, the east and the west, and then the 10 groups, the 10 nations, the 10 kings. Go back and listen to that program again from yesterday, posted at thetrumpet.com, and go through that prophecy. We went through Daniel 2 and also Revelation 17. So many details. God is telling us. God is showing us what to look for. We may not know the day or the hour, as Jesus said, but we can sure know the signs of the times. We can sure know when it's even near at the door. It's awesome, really, knowing the prophecies of God to understand and to see just how close we are. I mean, the disciples in the first century, they were so eager for the second coming of Christ. They were so eager for the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth. And they asked him. They asked Christ before he departed, when will you set up the kingdom? When will you establish the kingdom? And even after he left, even after he ascended to heaven, years later, during Paul's ministry, Paul was anxious, Paul was eager, Paul believed that it would happen in his own lifetime. And obviously it didn't. And quite a long period of time has passed since, 2,000 years. And look at how many people today don't even believe the prophecies of God regarding the second coming of Jesus Christ. It's not even talked about within most Christian denominations. It's not even brought up. It's not generally believed. Maybe there's a general belief among some of a rapture of some sort, even though that's not biblical. But how even with all of these prophecies of God that discuss Jesus Christ as being born to be king, Jesus Christ saying, if I go, I'm coming back. Jesus Christ setting his feet on the Mount of Olives, setting up God's headquarters government in Jerusalem. Well, coming back to some of the events of today, the sobering events. There's a lot of this, as we know, that's going to be happening before Jesus Christ ascends to the Mount of Olives. Five more people were killed in Israel over the last 24 hours or so. There were attacks in Tel Aviv, in the Israeli settlement, town of, what's the name of it? I think it's somewhere here in this article. It's near Jerusalem. The Telegraph says Israel has seen one of its bloodiest days in months, with two Israelis stabbed to death in Tel Aviv, and three other people killed in a shooting attack in the West Bank. So here are five gunned down, stabbed to death. An Israeli man, a Palestinian man, and an 18-year-old American tourist named Ezra Schwartz were all killed on Thursday when a Palestinian gunman opened fire from his car before ramming it into another vehicle. The attack took place in the Israeli settlement of Gush Etzion, south of Jerusalem, and came just hours after a Palestinian man fatally stabbed two Israelis outside an office building in Tel Aviv. And so the stabbings continue. The deaths of three Israelis and two other civilians makes for one of the highest daily death tolls since the latest round of violence began in October. Well, perhaps they're receiving inspiration from Paris. These radical Islamists. That's how Benjamin Netanyahu identified them. In a tweet, he said, "The beasts murdering us in our cities have a name. Radical Islam." They do have a name. It's radical Islam. Yesterday, we went through Carolyn Glick's take on these recent attacks. She's a journalist in Israel. Melanie Phillips is another one. She writes for The Times here in the UK. And in this piece, she's showing how these attacks, that they actually have everything to do with Islam. And yet, as she writes at the start of her column, even after the Paris atrocities, the West still isn't joining up the dots. Now you are seeing more of a reaction this time around, as we've been saying this week, much more so than you saw back in January. But there still are many, many Western officials, particularly in the United States, with the current administration, that aren't joining the dots. She rattles off what's been happening these last few years. Yesterday, you'll recall, we went through what's happened just in this year alone. But Phillips says here, the free world was shocked by 9/11, shocked by the 7/7 London bombings, shocked by the 2008 onslaught in Mumbai, shocked by January's Paris massacres at Charlie Hebdo and the kosher supermarket, and now it's shocked by ISIS, which it presents as nihilists. So they just happen to be the same type of nihilists as Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, Jaish al-Islam, and Boko Haram. And Phillips says, by an amazing coincidence, these all just happen to have the same aim, to spread Islam through holy war, using the same tactics of shootings, stabbings, beheadings, disemboweling, and human bomb attacks. Now, she points out later, of course, there's radical and moderate Muslims, but both of these draw on religious sources. It says the problem is that the radical interpretation, which takes literally the Quranic instructions to kill unbelievers and those who attack Islam, is backed by mainstream Islamic institutions and religious thinkers. Let me repeat that. This radical interpretation, which takes it literally, these instructions to kill the infidel, to kill the unbelievers, it's backed by mainstream Islamic institutions and religious thinkers. And yet we have leaders in the West who wonder why this is spreading, who keep going through these predictable reactions. What a shock! What a surprise! How could anyone do this? Al-Azhar University in Cairo, the nearest thing Islam has to religious authority, uses curricular materials which teach that war against the infidels is an obligation of all intelligent, healthy, free, and able men. It's an obligation for these young men. And so you can see why so many in Europe and in the United States are concerned. When so many of these refugees streaming in, I think the figure I've heard is about 70%, are young men, not widows and orphans, young men. She writes, the 57-state organization of Islamic cooperation, whose prime aim is to promote Islamic solidarity, excludes from its definition of terrorism, and therefore implicitly condones armed struggle against foreign occupation, aggression, colonialism, and hegemony. Holy war is being waged by Muslims drawing on the radical interpretation of Islam. The young Western Muslims they recruit are hooked through a lethal cocktail of social, political, psychological, and religious factors. And then later on in her column, she says, even among those many Muslims who abhor terror or theocracy, there are those still trapped by the implications of Islamic perfection. So in conflicts where Muslims initiate violence, Kashmir, Chechnya, Israel, or cultural aggression, such as censoring the Muhammad cartoons or criminalizing Islamophobia, they believe Muslims are instead victims of malevolent or murderous conspiracies. She says this helps to explain the poll, finding that 27% of British Muslims, 27% of British Muslims felt some sympathy for the motives behind the Charlie Hebdo attacks, with a further 10% saying they weren't sure or wouldn't say. Now, as I was mentioning yesterday, you only have to look at the numbers of the immigrants, the numbers of the refugees, the numbers when considering the Muslim population in France, in Germany, in the UK to know where this is headed, to know that we're headed to a spectacular clash, just as the Bible prophesies. Let me just finish her column. It says, this false victim culture is the toxic sea in which Islamic terrorism swims. To de-radicalize their young, the wider Muslim community has to say loud and clear that it's based on myths and lies, but how can they if they too subscribe to it? Finally, she says, worse still, it's hugely amplified by the echo chamber of the non-Muslim liberal society, which also blames the West for all the ills of the world, sanitizes terrorism, and promotes the doublespeak of victim culture. So that makes matters worse. That echo chamber of the non-Muslim liberal society, the apologists, the ones that sanitize the terrorism, the ones that are there promoting this victim culture. Think about what Secretary of State John Kerry said on Tuesday night, I think it was, where he was trying to draw a distinction between Charlie Hebdo, the attack there in January, and what happened last Friday night. He said there's something different about what happened at Charlie Hebdo. And I think everybody could feel that. Something different, he said. There was a sort of a particularized focus and perhaps even a legitimacy in terms of, and then he caught himself, not a legitimacy, I don't mean that, but a rationale that you could attach yourself to somehow and say, okay, they're really angry because of this and that. And then by comparison, he goes on and talks about what happened Friday and how that there's nothing to be angry about there. It was just absolutely indiscriminate. Killing people at a football game, killing people at a restaurant, killing people at a concert. But now with Charlie Hebdo, and this is thinking again, that no doubt draws inspiration from President Obama and his administration and others in this non-Muslim liberal society, as Melanie Phillips says, that can see that the terrorists, even some of the worst among them, they have some legitimate gripes. It's pretty amazing. Now, I think the Secretary of State has come out since that comment Tuesday and tried to clarify his comments. But this has been the norm for many years now. If you think about President Obama himself, I mean, he's spent years, 7 years, in fact, denying, even despite all the evidence to the contrary, that the religion of Islam offers any kind of inspiration to these many barbaric terrorist attacks. Let me just give you a sampling of what some of the comments that the president has made over the years, really stepping forward to defend this religion, to defend Islam.
The enduring faith of over a billion people is so much bigger than the narrow hatred of a few. Islam is not part of the problem in combating violent extremism. It is an important part of promoting peace. Thanks to the service and sacrifice of our brave men and women in uniform, the war in Iraq is over. The war in Afghanistan is winding down. Al-Qaeda has been decimated. So that's the current threat. Lethal, yet less capable, Al-Qaeda affiliates. The world is less violent than it has ever been. It is healthier than it has ever been. It is more tolerant than it has ever been.
Now, that last comment there, we've played comments like that before. The world's just getting better and better. There's always a few messes to clean up here and there. But the comments before that, I mean, this has been a staunch defender of the religion of Islam, And so you can see why at the news conference he had Monday in Turkey. I mean, here, you think about this scene, and these were all these reporters standing up to, this is 2-3 days after the attack in Paris, and one reporter after another, reporters presumably from the liberal left, who can see that this administration's policy regarding battling terrorism, fighting against ISIS, whatever it was, that there's problems, serious problems, that it's not working. Just before the attack, as you know, he was there on TV talking about how ISIS has been contained. And so he had to be going into Monday's back and forth with those reporters, dreading the thought of defending his policy. Nevertheless, though, he did defend it. He made it clear that the U.S. is not about to alter course. I'd like to just play a few snippets from that speech slash press conference. This first one here, where he's making it clear that the U.S. would continue on and maintaining the status quo.
Even as we grieve with our French friends, however, we can't lose sight that there has been progress being made. On the military front, our coalition is intensifying our airstrikes, more than 8,000 to date. We're taking out ISIL leaders, commanders, their killers. We've seen that when we have an effective partner on the ground, ISIL can and is pushed back. So local forces in Iraq, backed by coalition air power, recently liberated Sinjar. Iraqi forces are fighting to take back Ramadi. In Syria, ISIL's been pushed back from much of the border region with Turkey. We've stepped up our support of opposition forces who are working to cut off supply lines to ISIL's strongholds in around Raqqa. So in short, both in Iraq and Syria, ISIL controls less territory than it did before.
This is, as I say, this is 2-3 days after that attack, and really just incredible to you have people that are in shock still, even in the press, at what had just happened, at the fact that ISIS is, if anything, expanding and now moving into Europe on a large scale and telling us they're doing it, telling us they're going to put their terrorists in among the refugees. And then you have the leader of the United States of America talking about all the gains that America has made in this this battle. He also made comments about this attack in Paris being a setback, which many were offended by as well. Much worse than a setback. And of course, a large chunk of this exchange that he had with various reporters centered on the need for the United States to take in refugees from Syria. Here's one more clip.
We also have to remember that many of these refugees are the victims of terrorism themselves. That's what they're fleeing. Slamming the door in their faces would be a betrayal of our values. Our nations can welcome refugees who are desperately seeking safety and ensure our own security. We can and must do both.
And so this is what has so many in America up in arms across the board, not just among the Republican wing, but just the, well, at least, as many are saying, let's wait until we can properly vet these refugees, or at least let's go on the offensive, on the attack, to eliminate these threats. As it is, the same approach that's been a failure is what we'll see more of. He went on here and talked about the solution to these Islamic attacks or these terrorist attacks, as he sees it, and how that it was, in his view, diplomatic in nature. Here's another snippet.
Finally, we've begun to see some modest progress on the diplomatic front, which is critical because a political solution is the only way to end the war in Syria and unite the Syrian people and the world against ISIL. The Vienna talks mark the first time that all the key countries have come together as a result, I would add, of American leadership and reached a common understanding. With this weekend's talks, there's a path forward. Negotiations between the Syrian opposition and the Syrian regime under the auspices of the United Nations, a transition toward a more inclusive representative government, a new constitution followed by free elections, and alongside this political process, a ceasefire in the civil war, even as we continue to fight against ISIL.
And so more talking, basically, is the solution. Not action, but talking. Let's skip ahead one clip, Sam, and go to, I think this might be a question that he was asked regarding ramping up the fight against ISIS.
Thank you, Mr. President. A more than year-long bombing campaign in Iraq and in Syria has failed to contain the ambition and the ability of ISIS to launch attacks in the West. Have you underestimated their abilities? And will you widen the rules of engagement for U.S. forces to take more aggressive action?
No, we haven't underestimated our abilities. This is precisely why we're in Iraq as we speak, and why we're operating in Syria as we speak.
And so this led into what I think got quite a bit of play this past week, Monday and Tuesday, where the reporters kept asking him the same questions. Well, but what about this? But hasn't it been a failure? How come we can't get the bad guys? To the point where the president was, I think, visibly upset. If you saw the video, let me just read to you what Eli Lake wrote at Bloomberg View. This is from the 16th, earlier in the week. He said President Barack Obama couldn't have been looking forward to the press conference Monday in Turkey. Here he is overseeing the war he has said he's contained. And there his critics are asking why he hasn't done more to stop these barbarians who've just committed atrocities in France and Lebanon. Even still, the press conference stood out for how unpresidential the president was. In the wake of the tragedy, Obama spent much of his time scoring points against Republicans. He said his opponents wanted him to make a rash decision for the sake of a neat headline. If folks want to pop off and have opinions about what they think they would do, present a specific plan, he said. Exasperation in his voice. He even audibly sighed after the third question from a reporter asking why he appears to have underestimated the enemy. But then I want to draw attention to this last point, because he did on a couple of occasions talk about, well, the critics, if they want to pop off, then let me see their plan. I'm surrounded by the best advisors in the world. Let me see if they have a plan better than mine. And Eli Lake says here on Monday, he made a point of saying that he and his top advisors have analyzed recommendations to send more ground forces into Islamic State-controlled areas like Raqqa and Mosul. But ultimately, the experts concluded that U.S. occupation of those cities was not sustainable and should be done down the road by local forces the U.S. and allies are now training. Obama also went into some detail about why it wouldn't work to create safe zones for moderate rebels in Syria, where they would be shielded from Russian and Syrian bombing. Obama's answer in emphasizing, notice this, in emphasizing the input of his team of experts gives the impression that he is following the lead of the professionals. In reality, President Obama has overruled his top advisors many times in his presidency when it came to war in the Middle East. And this is true. There's been all kinds of reports about people just up in arms in the Pentagon or wherever, in the military. And that's the thing. It's because the leadership at the top has overruled these wishes. Because keep in mind, some of the grievances that these barbarians have are understandable. That's the thinking on the far left. That's the thinking among the liberal intelligentsia. That's the thinking that we have had a part, or that we have part of the blame. It's exactly what Melanie Phillips was saying. And for those, though, that are just looking at the facts on the ground, you can see why there are dramatic changes taking place in Europe. And while there might not be dramatic changes that happen in the leadership in the United States, you can certainly see why many Americans are up in arms. I think it's now 30 governors that have come together and said, no, if you send Syrian refugees to the United States, don't send them to my state. That's what a majority of governors in the states of the United States are saying. And yet this administration nevertheless presses ahead, labeling anyone who would be concerned about terrorists using the refugee crisis to infiltrate America. Anyone who would be concerned about that must be un-American. They must be racist. That's what much of the debate is about currently in the United States. All of it, doesn't it? All of it highlights just how weak America is. And you can see why, coming off of that attack Friday night, France, as we've covered this week, is looking to the EU. And you can see why member states in the EU are looking to downsize. You can see why they're looking to secure their borders. You can see why far-right parties in Germany are gaining in popularity. All these prophecies being fulfilled exactly the way it's spelled out in the Bible, just as Herbert Armstrong proclaimed throughout his 50-year ministry. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at kpcg.fm. Don't forget to send us your emails. We'll read a few of those in the next segment. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Well, if we had to rely on commercial revenue to fund this program, I think we'd be broke by now. I look at my watch and it's already 42, 43 minutes past the top of the hour, running out of time. These monologues keep getting just a little bit longer. So much is going on. There's so much happening in the news, though. So much that we need to be covering. So much that we know you're excited about following. Finally, a news source that's based on Bible prophecy, that's free of all the annoying distractions of commercials and advertisements and the like, where you can get so much packed into an hour or a half hour or a 500-word article. It's a real blessing, thetrumpet.com. It's a real blessing, the beautiful print magazine that we have, The Trumpet. Again, free of all the advertisements except for the ones that we make ourselves to advertise our own things, to promote our own publications, to promote our own programs. They do an excellent job at headquarters in Edmond. They do an excellent job here in the part that we have to play in supporting these publications and these programs and going through the news and finding all the nuggets that you need to know about, and finding the important stories that everyone else is overlooking. So many of you have been very appreciative of that, and we're happy to hear that and very much encouraged by it. This response coming in from Alabama says, great program today, as every day, meet in due season. I thank God always for your devotion and love for the work. I'm blessed to have access to the internet to receive the radio station here in Pell City, Alabama. This is the most truthful and timely source. Everything is just as God warned us. Yet still, most refuse to see. It's all playing out. Just as God has warned. Just as God has prophesied. And yet still, most people refuse to see it. I've talked some this week about that article from the Wall Street Journal about those students that are doing well in school just because they're taught to listen. And I was telling our students here yesterday how that this is a great challenge for us, as great as it is to have these programs, these commercial-free offerings, the Trumpet website, the magazine, and so on. Still, what a challenge it is. What a challenge it is to just try to get people to pay attention. To pay attention to what's happening in this world. To understand the significance of these events that we see unfold right before our eyes. Most people are distracted. They're distracted away from the truth of God because there's so much noise, there's so much confusion. This next response comes from Alaska. He says he listens on his cell phone during breaks at work and at other various times during the day. I greatly appreciate what God's servants are doing. There isn't any other news source out there that has such insightful broadcasts that also gives the news before it even happens. There's no other radio station out there like this one. Thank you, everyone, for this station that reaches worldwide. The original 12 apostles would be astounded to hear such a feat. And would they ever? If they had access to this kind of technology that makes it possible for us to stream a program from the cellar of an estate home so that it could go right around the world, down to South Africa, over to Alaska, in Canada, Alabama, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Ireland, Europe, so that you can get the news before it even happens. In class here at Edstone, we've been going through the gospel that Jesus Christ preached, the true gospel message. Gospel meaning good news. That's what he brought to this earth. It was a news announcement. It wasn't a reference back to something that happened historically. There's certainly history we can look at that would add to our meaning, our understanding of this gospel message. But this was a news announcement about a soon coming kingdom to be established on this earth. A kingdom with territory, with subjects, with a king, with an administration. A government administration underneath that king and his rule. This is how we receive our insight, our understanding of what's coming next. You think about that quote I gave to you yesterday from Mr. Armstrong talking about the eastern and the western leg in Europe. Five nations on the one side or five on the other, however it settles in its detail. 10 kings over 10 groups. That's what your Bible prophesies. Talk about news headlines before it even happens. That one was from 1981. Before that, he was talking about the Soviet Union. Back when it was racing the United States to get to the moon. Back when it was racing the United States to build more nuclear weapons. That's when Herbert Armstrong was saying, well, the Soviet Union is going to lose its grip on those eastern satellite nations in Europe. How could he know? Because the Bible informed him. Notice this next comment, another email response. It says, when the program started in May, I noticed an immediate correlation with my spiritual growth, hope, and urgency. I was really excited about this new tool for the work. As I scour every nook and cranny of every website and publication that I have access to in order to stay connected in some way to all the developments, in God's work. With KPCG, we can take in so much more information and even do it while accomplishing other tasks. With such busy lives, this is a huge gift from God. Also, there are so many things to learn in order to make us stronger and better equipped to teach, now and later. I was immediately thankful at what a tool KPCG was for teaching me so many things that I want and need to learn spiritually, and then also on so many other levels. We're able to take in so much more: history, politics, geography, economics, finance, industry, science, music, arts, culture, and of course, prophecy. Each topic is brought to life and made so much easier to learn, digest, retain, and use. I think about what your father said about being able to do so much more with the human voice. I think about all of the things I always want to understand better. With limited time, we can only take in so much information. We can only study so many things at once. Also, we live in a world where there is much less studying, quote-unquote, going on. So having a radio station and the various tools of technology that are attached through the internet makes reaching people on this earth a reality where they might never have had a chance to get the messages that they need in so many areas. She says many people will be more likely to remember what they hear, and there's a chance that they can get the message over and over again. They can also hear more of the intent as they listen to someone explain something where printed word is more to individual interpretation by the reader. She talks then later about the roundtable panel on the Trumpet Hour. She says it's amazing, an amazing experience to listen to programs that are put together according to God's way of doing things. There are panels of real, true experts, but who conduct themselves as those who know that they are really just students. There might be a group of men discussing one issue, but they're not fighting for the limelight, arrogantly tossing out their own ideas or seeking their own glory before the public. Everything's done in cooperation and toward a common and God-centered purpose. It's so exciting to see God's ways playing out in realms where we usually only see worldly examples. Everything is done so professionally, and it is clearly of the highest caliber. I'm always so proud of this product. Hopefully, that's an okay kind of pride. It's a pretty long response. I had to actually pare it down. Lots and lots of thoughts from this particular listener. Some nice compliments there for the team that supports Joel Hilliker on Trumpet Hour. Today, by the way, is Friday, which means we have Week in Review on Trumpet Hour later today. You'll want to tune in for that at 4 o'clock Oklahoma time, 10 o'clock p.m. here in the U.K., or in the drive to Leavesden in the morning for me and my family as we listen to the podcast. This last one here, another email response, kind of a humorous one at that. What I enjoy most, Mr. Fleury, is your ability to maintain your composure while presenting the most awesome, exciting, and mind-staggering news of the incredibly detailed unfolding of God's mighty project to bring humankind into his family. He says, you remind me of a fellow in the very front of a zooming roller coaster ride who has his arms comfortably folded and relaxed, and a relaxed smile on his face. How about that for a visual? From time to time, your enthusiasm and excitement for the rose-like blossoming of God's word is contagious, and we share your moments of overwhelming joy at what we are able to witness. Thank you, he says, for the daily. And thank you, all of you, for the responses that have come in. Continue to send those in to td@kpcg.fm. We love hearing from you. We love hearing about how you listen to the program. We love hearing about where you are, where you're listening to this program. It truly is, even though it's a small audience, It truly is a worldwide audience. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily radio show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, the live stream at kpcg.fm. We'll see you next week.